kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to episode number 60 of Today in Digital Education, the Tide podcast with me, Di Barnes, and...
me, Doug Belshaw. Di, how was your summer?
Well, it feels like it's been and gone, but it was fantastic. So I had 2 months off, and I've been to different countries and seen different people in, you know, like holidays in different ways, and they've all been really fab in their own way. So I very much enjoyed that. So I've been to Madrid and Crete, and then I had a week in America as well, which was really, really nice.
Oh, where did you go in America?
So I went over to Boston, oddly, and saw a friend of mine over there, and it was good. And I went to MIT, which was really cool.
Oh, did you? What did you do at MIT? Did you just like wander around, or did you actually
just wander around? It was all closed down. So we went to the visual arts gallery or whatever they have there. But then someone gave us a campus map, but really we were just taken by the architecture and walked around part of the media lab, maybe, or I don't think it possibly wasn't the media lab, just where they work, and it was. So it was really, really interesting, and I have to write a blog post about it, but the architecture is so funky and different that you just get the feeling that it would inspire you to think in a different way.
Hmm. Favorite came top of the league table, didn't it, for the best university in the world or whatever, based on research and everything like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, did it. It's very well regarded over there. I met this Australian student who was working at... another institute of technology, and he said he could no way afford to go to MIT, which I thought was sort of insightful. And he was just doing a 6-month session at, I think it was called Wellington or Winchester or something beginning with a W. But clearly MIT holds its, is quite very well regarded over there. But it was just really inspiring in the way that the sort of vibe you got around it. So I was kind of thinking it might be really good for a school trip at some point, actually, to take the pupils over there, because even though we weren't allowed into, you could go through the corridors and up and down the stairs, and it's all glass, so you could see into the workshops and where the people who are working there are doing their work. And they had an R&D pub, which was my favourite. I just thought, what a cool thing. So that was a really good time. And then it's just been getting ready for work again. Our school's got fantastic results. 60% of our grades are at A star at GCSE, which is like pretty amazing. So really, really amazing things in that way. And I'm starting my new job as a deputy husm, so a deputy housemaster, that is, to all real people.
So you've moved house?
So I moved flat.
And you're living with 62 boys.
I'm living with 62 boys, indeed, and a matron. That's all a bit weird, and getting used to that and different duties that I have. I'm just sort of adjusting and enjoying that, really. So it's all good. How about yourself? Tell me about your summer.
I'll let people read the blog post I wrote about my summer. It didn't go entirely according to plan, but we didn't really have loose plans anyway, so it involved ants infesting tents, my children getting sickness bugs, but also amazing things like just driving into the centre of Paris and parking in an underground car park almost underneath the Eiffel Tower next to like old Aston Martins and Bentleys and Rolls Royces and stuff, wandering around Paris with my children, getting in the car and then driving back to my campsite. It was just
fantastic.
But yeah, I think that's us done. Family camping. We left the tent in Devon. We'll next time we go camping in a couple of years' time, because we're trying to alternate these things, it'll probably be like a big camper van, maybe hopefully a VW California, which would be amazing.
They're great, aren't they? But they're not cheap. So I looked at them once because a friend of mine has his own converted VW Transporter.
Right.
So when we were on down in Cornwall, there's loads of VW camper vans down in Cornwall, the Transporter kind, not the old kind. The old kind are there as well. Mm. And the California, we had a good look around because it's all just been fitted out in all of its ways. And they cost like 45 grand or something. They're not cheap. But it was very impressive, very impressive.
Well, this is potentially the last summer. Oh, well, maybe the last camping holiday that we'll be able just to wander around Europe without having to get some kind of US-style visa or paying to go through the barrier or whatever it's going to be.
It's going to be an odd year next year, isn't it, with Brexit? So, my parents live in Hull, and Hull is the European City of Culture 2017. So they're going to hashtag it all differently into bye-bye, we love you really.
Yeah.
It's a very odd thing, I guess. I wonder if there'll be lots of visitors coming in that last, if you know, before they call dead on the European travel agreements.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know.
And they'll have to change all the passports and everything. Anyway, since I got back, obviously a month away from writing, although I did write a little thing on my iPad that I've got the keyboard for every day. That was just kind of a summary of what we did so I can put together the photo book. I started vlogging a lot more at my discourses blog. So I'm probably up to maybe 3 or 4 posts a day on there, just short ones, riffing off things that I read. Because I realised that I'm very similar to Laura Hilliger when she said to me the other day that she, I think I'll get this right, and sorry if I'm misrepresenting you, Laura, like, starting from scratch is not her or my strength. Starting from someone else's point of view and then creating something from that. I think John Cleese talks about this in one of the videos he once talked about. Like, it's, you steal like an artist. Like, Austin Kleon talks about this as well. So I very much prefer having some kind of prompt or stimulus. Might be Nuzzle, you know, I don't know if you use that to get to all
the... I do use Nuzzle, yes.
Might be an RSS feed reader, might be Hacker News, something like that. And then thinking about how that applies to your life. And yeah, it's good.
That is an interesting approach. But so the things that you've been blogging, is that based on things you've been thinking in your month off or?
Yeah, partly. I mean, so this is the thing. Like, creativity isn't just, you know, forming something from nothing. Creativity is, you know, putting a different spin on it, changing the shape of it, doing a different domain. And so really, a lot of these posts, I'm not going to claim any kind of value to them other than my own. What it is me thinking out loud. And so it's my perspective on this particular thing. And then, of course, you're always going to say, well, this thing is like that thing, and then linked off to other things, and then that sparks ideas, and then you go off on that. So it's a value to me because it helps me be able to put a URL to ideas that I have about other people's work and potentially spark new ideas and new approaches and that kind of thing.
Cool. And when you're... So, because people might be interested in listening, possibly. Please tweet me if you're not. When you're on Black Ops, do you consume everything in the same rate and just not actually write and do social media, or do you still consume the stuff? Do you know, are you still reading? Are you still doing that, or are you just?
That's an interesting question. So, in the early days of doing Black Ops, I would be extremely strict and I would just not look at anything. Mm-hmm. Whereas this time, I probably looked at Twitter, at my notifications and stuff, maybe every week, maybe a couple of times a week. Didn't do anything about it, didn't reply to anyone, even if they DM me, just didn't bother replying because they didn't know I'd seen them, obviously. Although I think you can see if people have seen your DMs now. I think they've just changed that on Twitter, haven't they? So you get,
I think that's becoming more of a thing. I know on Instagram, DM on Instagram.
It's annoying. I don't want people to know.
Well, it's a deal breaker for some, isn't it? And a deal maker for others, you know. So if you're an open comms app, I know your wife it likes being able to see when you're typing and when you're responding and you've read it and all of that. And WhatsApp does that really, really well in its sort of tick notifications and telling you what the person's doing at the other end.
And, I did that, and I started spinning up Feedly as an RSS reader again. So building back up my feed. And what I found really valuable about Feedly is their knowledge boards, and you kind of curate posts into whatever you decide. So I've got a knowledge board called Getting Stuff Done, which is all about productivity. I've also got one called The Unbearable Lightness of Being, which doesn't really have any particular focus other than, like, things that make me roll my eyes about humanity, or just something which taps into my own mental state sometimes and that kind of thing.
Mm, one of my favourite titles of all time, it has to be said. So, cool. Well, I should give a big shout out to Elan Ezekiel and to Amy Burval, who just visited me this weekend.
And, excellent.
Yeah, we had a bit of party time and they came and I had a great time together. So Amy's over from Hawaii working at a conference, learning and development conference, so like corporate teaching and learning, more or less, and doing this creativity thing, which was really, really cool, making a conference into a different kind of space and, you know, the participants actually interacting with each other and sharing stuff with each other in a kind of physical way, through digital mediums or whatever, you know. So that was kind of cool. It was great to see them. We had a great time.
Wonderful. Really, yeah. Really good.
Nice. Right, Doug.
We're going to change the format slightly of Tide, aren't we? So we used to have it. So it did the introduction, then we had education, technology, and then kind of productivity or miscellaneous stuff. Whereas I think we are reformatting this slightly to be maybe slightly shorter in length, although that's to be decided and to be seen, and have a main topic. So this week it's screen time. And then kind of have some miscellaneous links, which we'll do in a quick fire way at the end. So let's see how it goes. I mean, there's lots of links in here about screen time, so, and lots to talk about. So what do you think?
Well, I think it's going to be an interesting different kind of approach, and we'll see what comes out the other end and whether people like it and that kind of thing, or but I guess whether we like it as well.
And if people have got suggestions for what we should talk about as a main theme, we don't want to script it too far ahead because we want to be able to respond to what's happening in the week. You know, we want to be topical. And it does seem to be like when people have been going back to school, back to university, back to college, there has been the, you know, almost like the trope of, oh, kids on screen time, etc. So, let's start there.
Brilliant. Well, coincidentally, so Doug picked screen time. We didn't discuss this beforehand. He came up with this. We discussed the idea. We might muck about with the format of Tide a little bit. And but at the beginning of the summer, I read an article by Jose Picardo. Hello, Jose, if you're listening. Or Jose. I don't know. Okay. Called Not All Screen Time is Equal, Some Considerations for Schools and Parents. It's a very good article. But the first one we're going to discuss is called Screens in Schools Are a $60 Billion Hoax.
So this was in both The New Yorker and in Time magazine, because the author, Dr. Nicholas Cardoas, has a book out called Glow Kids, How Screen Addiction is Hijacking Our Kids and How to Break the Trance.
How to break the trance.
So there's the usual stuff in here, and fair enough, it's a $60 billion industry, right? That's because technology is expensive. But it talks about let me just read this paragraph, because it's indicative of the kind of pseudo scientific approach to this kind of thing. He says, tech in the classroom not only leads to worse educational outcomes for kids, which I'll explain shortly, it can also clinically hurt them. I've worked with over 1,000 teens in the past 15 years, and I've observed that students who have been raised on a high-tech diet not only appear to struggle more with attention and focus, but also seem to suffer from an adolescent malaise that appears to be a direct byproduct of their digital immersion. Indeed, over 200 peer-reviewed studies point to screen time correlating to increased ADHD, screen addiction, increased aggression, depression, anxiety, and even psychosis. End of quote.
Crumbs. Okay, that's difficult. And this is a very, very pointy article. So the paragraph above the one you just read is 4 words long, and it says, this is a lie. Talking about the screen revolution and the seismic shift that technology dominates the educational landscape.
When I was away during the summer, I think I mentioned on one of the previous episodes of Tide, I had purchased, during the Amazon Prime Day, I'd purchased the Kids Fire tablet for both of my children. So they're the ones with the big rubber bumpers.
Yeah.
And my daughter was fine, who's 5, and chose to come off it and all that kind of stuff. Whereas my son made sure that he had the amount of time that we had allocated to him. And we ended up giving him an hour a day between 12 midday and 6 in the evening. And it was up to him how he allocated that. But we found that after lunch he tends to be better at this stuff. But I did have to take it off him. And that's because he was sneaking on it, changing things around, going on things when he shouldn't have done, etc. And I thought that his behaviour was a direct result of screen time, in inverted commas. But it turns out, Di, because you're spending so much time in close proximity to people and you can see how people react, I realised that actually any day where we didn't do exercise, and I don't just mean like walking down to the local town, but I mean like swimming, running about the place, whatever it is, any day where he didn't really do much exercise, the next day his behaviour just wasn't very good. And I feel like a lot of the stuff that's in this article isn't really about technology. It's about inertia and just kids not moving about.
I think this is a really important point. Thank you for sharing something that's so sort of personal to your life, you know. But because I think it is a really important point, is that screens get blamed for everything that emerges from what, the year 2000 onwards, more or less, or the 2005. I'm sure if we trace back the sort of ubiquitous acceptance of mobile phones, we'd find the point. But you look at it like that, and you look at people talking about computer games, violent computer games in the past. You look at people talking about the amount of television that you'd watch. I know when I was a kid, I watched lots and lots of television. But I also lived outside quite a lot. So, up trees, on streams, and making swings and whatever, playing football, doing stuff outside. So I think it's really, really important that that for every single case where you're going to gather evidence of the thousands of teens in the past 15 years, that you're actually aware of what their life is, and you're aware that of what their diet is, of what their exercise regime is, and those things are going on before you start pointing, like psychosis, anxiety, depression, aggression, ADHD, all at the idea of screens, and when really... The other side of that is a $60 billion, which I would question that figure as well, because, use of tech in school is often very little to do with children. That it would be important to actually analyze what that individual is doing, good things that are accepted good things, as in good diet and exercise, in their lives, before you go around saying that they're depressed and they're anxious and that screens are causing this.
There's, I'm not going to link to it here because, well, maybe I'll get time to in a moment. But in one of Dana Boyd's books, I think it's, which one is it? I can't remember. Anyway, so in one of Dana Boyd's books, she talks about how kids just haven't got physical spaces to go anymore. So we're the best one in the world, and we've talked about this before as well.
We have.
We're the best one in the world. I can't let my 9-year-old, now he's in middle school and he walks to school by himself, is a bit more leeway. But certainly up to that age, I couldn't just let him roam about the place because I would be castigated as a parent. And also, no one else let their kids do that, so it would be pointless. He'd be wandering around by himself.
So when I used to wander around by myself, as I imagine that you did when you were a child, my parents knew all the phone numbers of my friends. They knew which friends I would be with. They would ask who I'd be with, and they would know that if I wasn't seen by at tea time, as it were, when I was expected back in the house, they would know who to contact and which parents they would contact and all of that. And you'd have thought with social media and that as well, now, communication being much more prolific, as it were, the capacity to do it, that people could get on with that. And I don't know.
You'd really think that'd be an enabler, wouldn't you? But if you look at some of the stuff that Dana Boyd and other people talk about teenagers, basically... The physical space in which they can gather is massively reduced. So, they don't want to be in the house where their parents are in control of that surroundings. They want to be out, outside shops these days. They might play classical music. They might have annoying things which stop them from congregating. They're asked to move on from various places. And maybe they don't want to do sports. So, there's not many places where they can hang out. So you'd think, great, one of the places they can hang out is virtually. Yet that's seen as a problematic thing. And I think Jose, in his article, gets to that. My dad, when I was younger, he would sit and read the paper in the lounge, and I wouldn't see his face because he'd be behind the paper for ages reading the whole paper. Yet we didn't see that as a bad thing. Yet if we replaced... the parent sitting on the chair with an iPad reading, ignoring the child. I mean, my dad was great, he spent lots of time with me, but I'm just giving it as an example. If we put an iPad there, we go, oh my goodness, look at this parent ignoring the child because they're transfixed by the iPad.
This is it, and this is exactly right, isn't it? And there's that beautiful picture that I've seen online of everyone being absorbed in their broadsheet newspapers on the train, a commuter train,
In the 1950s or whatever.
Exactly, and then people on their phones with their headphones on, and everyone laments how it's causing you not to look up and see the world around you and hear the noises that are around you, and it comes back to this thing again, a Dana Boyd thing, of the children when they're online are usually increasing their communication with those that they're nearest nearest to, you know, those that they love. They're like usually family members and their best friends, you know. So whereas I don't doubt that the use of social media can, in particular, can create levels of anxiety and difficulty understanding how to negotiate the modern world and socially more than any other way, it's still not the cause of all of those, that list of dreadful symptoms, you know, dreadful conditions that young people can get themselves into. So one of the things that you have to align or get aligned is the idea of screen time with the mental health issues that are so much more prolific for young people in the modern day. But really, mental health issues are things that I would argue people have suffered throughout time, and certainly in my lifetime, and that all that's happening now is people are talking about it more and sharing it more, and that is something that technology has facilitated.
I've forgotten the name of the term for this, but it's like projecting. So what we tend to do is, as adults, we project how we feel as fully reflexive adult people who have been through childhood onto our kids, and it's just not the same for them. So
that's right.
Now, my son and boys do this especially. They get obsessed by stuff. Yeah. So whether it's World of Warriors cards or a football, collecting football cards or whatever it is. Recently, which is great, we've got the whole set of Famous Five books, and he read six Famous Five books in 4 days, and just it couldn't stop him reading, and then he just stopped for some reason, and now he's on to doing something else. And that's just the way that a lot of kids, especially boys, work. Doesn't mean it's bad.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Pokemon Go is a good example of this as well. Yeah. And I don't think it's not a bad thing. In fact, it's something you possibly want to encourage, is that ability to immerse yourself within a rabbit hole for a little while, you know, and you do something and you do it a lot for a short amount of time while you satisfy your curiosity, if you like. And enjoy it, and then move on.
So and fair enough, you know, if we're talking about, and we've had these conversations about, especially your duty of care in a boarding school, but let's say that it's to do with getting addicted to porn on the web or something which is obviously harmful and done in large chunks, then obviously we have to intervene at that point. But the rest of the time, I think what we need to do is set reasonable limits and give them freedom within that.
I think so. I mean, well, I once had to deal with a young man. I'm not sure if I discussed Untied or not, but with a young man who was believed to be addicted to manga porn.
Wow.
And so when I actually spoke to him and we sat and talked for an hour and a half, and it was a difficult thing, you know, he was quite tearful and things like that. And he had really the bleakest set of cards that a person could be dealt for someone of his age. He was 17 at the time, I think. And what he did is he was just in a process of escapism, but he wasn't obsessed with manga porn. He was watching a massive series of manga stuff, and there was a little bit of inappropriate sexual content in it at certain points, but that was never the gist of it, and it wasn't why he watched it. You know, they're just 20-minute episodes, and he could just never resist clicking next, kind of binge-watching thing.
Yeah,
and but when you actually looked at the detail of what was going on, there was not a sort of sexually a harmful, sexually deviant thing going on for him at all. And yet that thing you were talking about, that projection, which I think in psychoanalysis they call it transference. You know, you transfer... a patient, a client would transfer things onto you, the psychoanalyst or psychotherapist, and you would have to be aware that that was being transferred onto you and that you're sitting with those shoes on, kind of thing in your work. But and that's what people do, is that they think of the darkest spot upon their spectrum of thought, and they pick on that and say, well, this is what the child is experiencing. And often I think that's not really the case. And I get a little bit frustrated, and it's part of my job, I guess, but it's that management of what is actually going on with the technology for the young people and people who are those managing those people's lives, in a way, the children's lives, are not familiar with actually what it is that they're doing. They don't understand what YouTube is. They don't understand what social media is. They don't understand Snapchat. They don't, they've never used it, you know, and it's not because they're foolish or anything. It's because they just don't know. And part of my job is to kind of make sure their eyes are as open as can be to the idea that that social media or whatever. So I'm going to run a session tomorrow, a Lower Six induction session, an hour long, which is going to be me talking about social learning and encouraging the Lower Six to actually look at using social media to build a network of some sort, or to start building their feed, you know, and start building the idea that you can use social media for these ways that support their academic purposes, and as well as their social ones, and that kind of thing. So yeah,
and from a, I think it needs to be several pronged attack. Like you need to. So another parent at, in Ben's year has, you know, like lots of people just given their kid a smartphone and then realised, oh my goodness, like he doesn't know how to use it, even though he's been watching me use mine. Like, he doesn't know like not to text people at 5:30 a.m. when he just wakes up and, yeah, and all that kind of stuff. But then from a teacher's point of view as well, I was talking to Sarah Horrocks, hi Sarah if you're listening, from London Connected Learning Centre last week, and she was talking about the idea of research literacy for teachers, and I think they're going to do events in conjunction with Research Ed run by Tom Bennett and other people. But there's this idea, especially as we're entering a time of teachers, a lot of teachers not going through a university route of education, so potentially not really having a background in critiquing the very system of which they're part and how to look at the research behind things. So I'm just looking at this Verge article now, and it actually takes issue with this guy, Nicholas Cardoas's article. So this particular one is called Why Calling Screen Time Digital Heroin is Digital Garbage. And so the author, who is Rachel Becker, if you scroll down to underneath the picture of the person holding a smartphone where it says all of us have changed the way we live because of the way we use these devices, you know, it mentions very specifically that she's gone to have a look on Google Scholar and elsewhere to find out whether this guy has published any peer-reviewed publications about tech addiction, internet addiction, or psychology. And guess what? He hasn't.
Yeah, you
know, he's a doctor. He has clients and patients and stuff. But he says that says in an interview with The Verge, Cardoas didn't dispute that he hasn't published in the peer-reviewed literature. Instead, he said he wanted to reach the broadest audience possible by publishing in the popular press. All right? Now, that to me smacks of what Mark Prensky did when he coined the term digital natives. So, not a peer-reviewed article, stuck out there. People take the term as being scientific or describing reality, and we've had to untangle that mess for the last 10 plus years. Now, as somebody who also doesn't publish in peer-reviewed journals, I'd hope that people wouldn't take anything I'd written as being objective truth, but only like one person's view on things. So I think there is definitely, when it comes to parents, when it comes to teachers, a degree of digging that you have to do behind the article. To actually find out what's going on here and what his biases are, and the fact he's trying to sell books, etc. It's really difficult to, especially when people are using very emotive metaphors like digital heroin. It's problematic.
Well, this is exactly the same things that you're saying here, or exactly what I wrote about back in 2013 when Dr. Eric Sigmund visited our school, and he does the rounds in the private independent schools of England, as far as I'm aware, and it's just all the same things, because he was again, he actually did publish in, I can't remember what journal it was, let me just get the article back up, but some medical journal, he actually did publish in there, but essentially his publication got turned into Daily Mail headlines, and did that, and then Dr. Ben Goldacre of badscience.net tore him to pieces on a Newsnight interview, which is embedded in the in the blog post. And it was just because his research is not scientific to the extent that Sigmund had even used the results of some research conducted by a couple of guys in America. And before Sigmund published his work, these guys had done some more research, poo-pooing the results that they found in their original research. But he didn't include that, you know. So he was cherry-picking his sources so he can say what he wants to say in the way that does it. But even Sigmund, and to be fair to him, talked about screen time being different things, you know. So if you were... So depending on... It's about being passive was the thing. But if you were actually active in your screen time, you were thinking and you were working. So he didn't count screen time as... or harmful screen time as doing schoolwork, because you were thinking about something and you were processing stuff in your mind. Your mind was busy, therefore your brain activity is busy, and it's not passive stuff that people are scared of.
The thing is, so we talk about harm, and if you think about all the different harm that could happen from looking at a screen a lot. So I have a condition which means that I get lots of glare. All right, so. I have to use screen temperature controls and all that kind of stuff, and so it literally hurts my eyes to look at screens a lot, which is ironic given my chosen kind of occupation. And it's supposedly harmful to use a keyboard for a long period of time, especially if you don't use it properly. But mm-hmm. then these things are kind of true of lots of things. So, for example, if you decide you want to learn to play the piano and you play the piano a lot, you could get RSI. If you're an illustrator, you know, an artist, they have a... So all of these things, if you do them to extreme, have problems. But showing the extremes and saying that that's... We need to not do the middle-of-the-road thing because the extreme thing is extreme, mm-hmm. it is ridiculous. So lots of people enjoy the odd gamble or the odd flutter on the Grand National or whatever. But yes, there's people who get addicted to gambling, but it doesn't mean that... You should ban all types of gambling or anything which is going to cause RSI or whatever. And I think that the benefits massively outweigh the problems. So moving on to Howard Rheingold's post on DML Central, uh-huh. he has written something called A Conversation About Screen Time. And he talks about his daughter, who I think works at Google. And there's such a wonderful line in here, in the first paragraph. It says that... the first paragraph says, I raised a millennial who is now in her 30s. We dealt with the fact that she did her homework while engaging in multiple instant message conversations and watching television in the background. Her response, when I stop making straight A's in school, maybe it's a problem.
Well, there you go. But I think that is the case, isn't it? I mean, that's something that we face here, is that children are very successful in their education and they're doing this stuff as well. It's just doing things in different ways. Hmm. If I just refer back to the last paragraph of the article that you, the heroin article from The Verge.
Oh, right, yes.
It just says, just as we need to learn to drive a car safely, we need to learn how to drive the internet safely. Again, this is another tool that increases our freedom, increases our ability to do things, but has also has great potential danger. But we don't get in cars thinking, oh, I could get addicted. And,
any metaphor we use does seem slightly ridiculous, but yeah. I was at Gateshead Library yesterday, just figuring out how I could work with them and all that kind of stuff. And they're doing some wonderful, wonderful work with Coda Dojo, etc. But you know, and this was out without me prompting. What the problem they raised was that it's easy to get people's attention. It's relatively easy to get grants and money to do some work around coding because there's the whole curriculum, etc. But what they noticed was that kids just don't really have the digital literacy that goes around that stuff to know what's appropriate in different situations and almost like the social norms around being on screens together and everything like that. And so I was interested in potentially badging those things, but even that I thought might be slightly reductive if it was done badly. But mm-hmm. the idea that if you just give kids stuff, they know what to do with it. You know, I've had personal experience of that with my son just going being ridiculous with an iPhone when I gave it to him, and then going back and he's now got a Nokia 230, which is so basic you can't even use predictive text.
Okay.
But some of the kids at his school, he's in middle school, he's 9 years old, don't have mobile phones. Some of them have like unlocked, no restrictions, 4G Android or iPhone devices. He's got a basic kind of feature phone. These things emerge over time. And it is an interesting conversation to have as to whether it's worthwhile. So we've grown up with these things, so we know where they came from, we know the evolution of them or whatever. My five-year-old daughter, you know, the stuff that is now is the worst stuff she's ever seen, and it's only going to get better from here. So, like, the worst phone she's ever seen is, like, an iPhone 6. So she doesn't know where this stuff's come from. She doesn't really, like, everyone instant messages or using Telegram or whatever, you can send pictures. Like, she doesn't get used to be able to just do text. So I guess what I'm coming at is... is there something to be said for starting kids off at a point before the latest and greatest so they can learn where things came from and build up to there? Or is that just really anachronistic and forcing them to relive what we had to go through?
Yes, completely. Rather than giving them the thing that allows them direct access to the functionality that's available in their time.
Hmm.
Yeah, I kind of go for that. Back in the DNL article... Howard has an interview with a lady called Constance Steinkuhler. Apologies if I got that name wrong, it's German, and not my strength. But she specializes in gameplay, computer game playing, and has gone through periods of moral panic and hype about gamification of learning, it says. And I'm reading now. And now that the hype curve has given way to backlash and the backlash has started to die down, she thinks the best work on game screens and learning is being done. And there's a link there to her website, which is called, I'm not going to the link, but it's called gameslearningsociety.org. And so Dr. Steinkuhler grew up on a farm and recalls that her parents feared that she was spending an unhealthy amount of time reading books. And boomers, I'm assuming that's baby boomers, apparently ruined our minds with now old-fashioned television.
Mm.
Clearly, there are pitfalls and opportunities in screens as entertainment and education devices.
Seriously, when I look back at some of the stuff that I used to watch and, you know, show to my kids, like, I'm not going to use Tom and Jerry because that seems ridiculous, but if you do look back at some of the Tom and Jerry stuff, it's super violent. And my kids do end up punching each other after watching it. And some of the stuff is really racist or sexist. And you think, hang on a minute. And I used to get up by myself and watch this in the morning. And you just think, I was unsupervised. I'm not saying I had bad parents. Everyone did this. But I was unsupervised, watching a screen passively, imbibing cultural stuff from America, and also just having a world view placed upon me, as opposed to, you know, my kids do Duolingo before school. They're learning a language. They're on a screen. That's a good use of a screen. Like Jose says, all screen time isn't equal. It's interesting that she says, Dr. Steinkuhler says, that the best work is already now being done.
Mm. Which is right, isn't it? I mean, it's the right thing. Is that the work we're doing now should be the best work about this stuff that's going on, I think. Mm.
She is part of the work that she thinks is the best work.
Yes, of course. But that's also fine. She's an expert in her field and saying her field is healthy. You know, I don't really have a problem with that. But I remember watching the television that I watched with my children as opposed to the stuff that I watched personally as a child. It was pretty cool. So I remember watching Malcolm in the Middle, which was a long, long series of a family of four boys and their mum and dad, starring Hal, who is, I don't remember the name of the actor, but the guy who played the lead in Breaking Bad. Really very good, superb series, really, really articulate and clever and well thought through, very well written, a bit like The Simpsons, really. We used to watch cartoons like Recess and Braceface and different things like that. And again, the stories were complicated. They were about children at school dealing with their lives, and it was really, really interesting, and dealing with their parents in some cases, and how they rubbed along and how their friendships were and that kind of thing, you know. So lots of sort of interesting and good quality television, I would argue, from America, actually, all of those.
So the last article is really interesting because it talks about, so this is the one in the Independent, which I actually picked up this last week. Someone shared it, The Age of Distraction, Why the Idea Digital Devices Are Destroying Our Concentration and Memory is a Myth, from The Independent.
Okay.
The great thing about this article is it talks about how all the way up to the 20th century, different revolutions in reading was seen to be the problem. Like, people not paying attention because they're too busy reading. It's going to addle their minds. And why can't they just be present in the real world? And then, kind of since the 20th century, people bemoaning technology because it takes people away from reading, which is slightly ironic.
Yes, yes. It's funny, isn't it, how that's kind of flipped. And because I would argue that a lot of technology is reading, and it's a physical thing of reading, but it's a different form of it. And essentially, people are just never happy with what's going on. That's what it feels like, doesn't it? You know, it's like there's always, and goddamn these pesky kids kind of thing going on of, the youth today and all that nonsense.
Well, there is as not only as technology gets more embedded in society, we're still less than 10 years. It was less than 10 years ago that the first iPhone came out, isn't it? So, we're still early days here. And also, as generations get older and their use of technology is normalized, then these things are just going to become commonplace, and we're not going to have the moral panics that you mentioned before, and we're not going to have the, oh my goodness, what are we going to do with the next generation? They're just looking at screens all the time, because we realize that there's etiquette around screens and there's different ways of doing stuff.
And it's quite interesting is that etiquette is for young people, it's not the same etiquette as it is for us. It's quite interesting. So people always want to impose their views and their stance on things without really thinking about what it's like growing up with these things. But when I talk to people about it, adults usually, I say, well, what you're experiencing now and what you're seeing and you're commenting on right now, I said, this is nothing. I said, you can have this argument if you want and you can hold this opinion if you like. But it's not anywhere near as much as it's going to be. This is going to be much, much more for these children and for the children of our children kind of thing, because it's just not going to be questioned. And anything that streamlines and provides a sort of ergonomic access to personalized, bespoke information that you can tweak and push to yourself, then it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. That is the way we're going to consume it. So there's no point having that strange kind of screen time argument unless you're going to say, this is the way we're going to feed the information through e-ink or whatever, through.
Well, it's easier to say, look at this technology. It's this technology's fault. It's not, instead of saying, that's bad teaching or that's poor parenting or that kid hasn't had enough exercise or whatever, it's easy to say, oh, too much screen time.
Well, it's probably worth mentioning as well that there's the sort of leading work that's going on with the NHS battling the general increase in mental health issues that society is experiencing. This is not child-centred. Doctors are actually recommending that people join a club, a society that does a sort of physical sort of activity, like a dancing society or something like that, or lawn bowls or something like that, and that they get involved actually socially because that's connected to your mental state and or your general mental well-being, and obviously involves an element of exercise, and that's quite interesting. That's the leading treatment, if you like, for things that are seen as big problems. And
there is a lot of what we're doing on digital devices, which is communicating with other people. So whilst it looks in the physical world like we're not connected with other people and we're doing things by ourselves, of course we're connecting with all these other people. Now, if you're just doing that and you're not connecting in the physical world with other people, that's problematic. But just because we can't see what's happening and that connection and everything like that doesn't mean that it's not there.
Mm. Well, I think there's always going to be an element to which it's like, can you look up from your screen, please? Or, we're here in the same space and I would like, we're talking and it would be quite good if I didn't have to feel like I was competing with your screen. But that's an element of just like negotiating your space, and that everybody knows the environment in which you're working or the sort of field of players are like, if you like.
Well, it's setting the ground rules and etiquette and that kind of thing. We're doing a lot of thinkathons through the We Are Open co-op at the moment.
Uh-huh.
And it's weird because it's all adults involved, but when you're running workshops or facilitated thinking, you kind of have to set the ground rules. Even more so, I was on one last week where I was remote, and Brian Mathers, hi Brian if you're listening, was in the room. And, you know, there's ways in which you can negotiate that space in a funny way. Like he kept a tally of how many times Doug overrules Brian. all that kind of stuff. Or there's like, you know, we're going to need you present in the room, so, you know, we understand if you do need to check emails, please could you leave the room, or, you know, whatever it is. So that people understand that continuous partial attention for this part isn't acceptable. It might be appropriate other parts. Just on that, actually, I've found that since I came back from holiday, blocking out my mornings as much as possible to be kind of social media and Slack and other kind of things which you're never sure when you're going to get a connection. If I can keep those free of that and then kind of connect in the afternoon, I find that a lot better. But that doesn't mean that screen time is wrong. In the morning, I'm doing my screen time by writing and organizing my life and stuff.
Yeah, well, there we go. You know, this is what computers do. They facilitate such a broad range of different activities.
Do you remember that that image where it shows a desk? I'll see if I can find it. It shows a desk from like 30 years ago with all the different things that you had to have separate. Now everything's just in a smartphone.
I do. I know the image well.
Well, that's basically what we're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But even more so, it's even more than that, isn't it? Because the desk is... Yeah, I've never owned a desk like that. You know what I mean? It's just not part of my life. And I've never worked in an office. And I've sometimes had a working desk as a teacher, but never like that, if you see what I mean. It's usually a working desk in the classroom kind of thing. Therefore, it's not covered in all those different bits and bots that get replaced over time. But it's even more activities than that desk presents. It's a great gift, though, isn't it? It just shows the emergence of desktop publishing and all of these different things, yeah. And then going onto your phone.
Okay, have we got anything else to say on screen time?
I do not.
Well, I tell you what, why don't we do this? Why don't we invite the people who are listening, hi, ma'am, to give their...
Hi, Doug's ma'am.
To give their responses to this, and maybe if there's enough of them, or there's some interesting ones, we can read those out at the start of next week's podcast, and then we'll have a different focus, obviously, for the main chunk of next week's podcast.
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay. Well, with that in mind, then, let's move on to miscellaneous. We've got five links in here. So the first one is kind of related, actually. It was linked to from Lifehacker, which, if you've never seen Lifehacker before, people listening, I highly recommend it. It's kind of just mainly tech-related stuff, but things related to like productivity in the 21st century. This particular one was linked to. It's called From Demagogues to Mental Fog, The Side Effects of the Information Age.
Great name. Lovely bit of assonance, From Demagogue to Mental Fog. So what's this about?
Well, this one actually links to peer-reviewed research and quotes people, and it talks about several things. It talks about what Professor Tom Nichols calls the death of expertise. So he's saying that it's not the death of actual expertise. So I'll read this, but he says, by this, I do not mean the death of actual expertise, the knowledge of specific things that sets some people apart from others in various areas. There will always be doctors, lawyers, engineers, and other specialists in various fields. Rather, what I fear has died is any acknowledgement of expertise as anything that should alter our thoughts or change the way we live. End of quote. So his point is that, like you said before, someone comes up with a position, screen time is bad, and then looks for research to back up that thing. And that's so much easier in the age that we live in, that people don't take expertise as meaning that that they should have to change their mind about anything. There's that point. And he talks about unfalsifiability and things as well. But I think the main thing in here is that if we just go through life, tethered to our smartphone, just looking at every notification that comes up, that's the other thing I've done. I've taken off any social media apps off my phone. If we just look at any kind of notification as they come, he talks about this kind of mental fog that we're in, so that we're never really clear what we think about stuff, and we're easily guided and manipulated. So he says that, you know, demagogues like Donald Trump play on this and use things which sound kind of truthy, so we kind of it kind of goes with what we already think. So we're just like, yes, I'll press like on that, I'll agree with that.
That's quite, yeah, it's quite interesting, isn't it? I mean, that's the way. So quite often you get clickbait that leads you to a sort of tagline that makes you think this is cutting through the fog kind of thing. But again, I would argue, similar to our screen time conversation, really, is that as I reflect on my life, I think I've always been a bit foggy, you know, pre-tech, post-tech kind of thing. And if anything, the technology allows me to find, to dig deeper and look at the information more. Or maybe I just am appeasing a point of view which I'm looking to find, but that's the nature of me. You know, I always look at things from different angles. And when I feel comfortable somewhere is when I change my shoes kind of thing. Not that I may. But it's that sort of thing. You kind of, I don't know. It's difficult. But it is important, obviously, to note when you get demagogues coming through saying, this is the way. But welcome to the human condition, you know. People want to build up.
One of the things, so when I came back from holiday, I read a blog post by Douglas Rushkoff, he of Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus fame and Program I'll Be Programmed and Present Shock, all great books. He has started a new podcast called Team Human, and there's four episodes out. It's at teamhuman.fm. And so I've listened to all four episodes. It's great. He's got he interviews people and he kind of gets on his soapbox and stuff. And he talks everything about everything from like buying up debt and then forgiving it to kind of what it means to what does solidarity mean in this day and age and cooperative working and greening the media and all sorts of stuff. But the thing that he's getting at is that society now, if you look at the way the stock market's focused and the way that the tech market is done, it's all focused on machines, and humans are almost an inconvenience, hence the Team Human podcast. He's on Team Human and encourages us to do something similar. And it's worth thinking about the fact that maybe, I know you mentioned that even pre-tech you were a bit foggy, but I'm fairly sure that the way that we do notifications, the way that some of the default way in which our technology is set up, contributes to that mental fog. And one of the things we can do to be more human is to have a more intentional approach to what we're going to do, not just do what everyone else does, but maybe not respond to that direct message straight away, but actually wait a bit and wait on our terms or just turn things off in the morning or whatever it's going to be, whatever works best for us.
And this is exactly the sort of thing that we need to be working with in schools, I'd say, is that we need to be helping young people learn the process of negotiating this information that's out there, how they curate it, how they what they read, but also how they respond. And when they're called to arms, as it were, do they choose when they respond to a notification and managing their notifications. And I think tech is going to offer in the next few years, it's going to really improve. I think it started to, but it's going to really improve with how notifications are delivered to us. So that it doesn't feel like it's controlling our lives, and that the tech is slave to us and serves us well, rather than it being the other way around, which is often happens. That's why I think a lot of these anxieties come from, is people are worried that the tech's going to rule what you have to do, because a lot of this is to do with older people possibly not getting on top of their tech, and therefore feeling like email is always pushing their workflow and this, that, and the other, and they need to really define that working process that they have and be in charge of it, Maybe. Lots of learning to be done, I think.
I think so. I just had a quick look at Stanford University's Calming Technology Lab. One of my former colleagues in Mozilla came from there. She was also a yoga teacher, one of the most chilled out people I've ever met. But it says that their Calming Technology Lab is currently on hiatus because they spun out a company, and they've all left to join the company.
Is that right? Okay, and well, that's a good sign, isn't it? Because it sort of shows that, assuming that the company is dealing with the same material, that the work that they were doing that was brought together within the university environment, and therefore with some sponsorship of some sort, you'd imagine, is worth pursuing.
Yes. You know? Well, hopefully we'll see. But I mean, what tends to happen is that one app finds a way of doing stuff, and then that's widely copied. Usually that's to do with extracting as much data or profit out of things as possible. But maybe it's to do with allowing people to be more human. We can but hope.
Well, it naturally, all these things will lead to that. Because, further down the line, if you like, It's going to be, that human behavior is going to dictate these things ultimately, because people just aren't, you know, they might be there in the moment or in the present day, but in the future, they're going to get bored of it unless it's actually serving a purpose for them that they subscribe to, you know, hopefully.
Mm. There's a really interesting post. The next one, it's on commonsense.org. So we all know about Common Sense Media. Uh-huh. This is Common Sense Education, and this is by Chris Gilliard, a professor, and he and Hugh Kulick, both community college professors. And it's entitled Digital Redlining, Access and Privacy. And it uses the metaphor of a map and places that you are and aren't allowed to go.
Mm-hmm.
And talks about how some of the, like, you can see, if you, so I use this metaphor actually in a post which is going to be published on DML Central this week. In the UK, we have the right to roam. And so on a map, you can see the areas in which you have the right to roam. And my understanding is in the US, it's a very narrow path that you're allowed to go on through landowners' property. So there's definite boundaries. You're allowed here and you're not allowed there. But online, it's less clear where those boundaries are. And he uses the example of, you know, let's say that you want to get an academic article and you want to see everything that's available in that particular area, and you're at a community college and you access JSTOR. Well, the chances are, he says, that this student is probably using one of the smaller versions of the database that's offered to that kind of college. So you're not aware of all the stuff that's out there. And it talks about black neighborhoods, and it talks about algorithms that kind of negatively affect certain people who are point scored based on their likelihood to do certain things. I don't know if I'll be able to find it quickly, but there was something I did read over the summer, which was about a parent who was pretty much on the warpath because they found that their kid couldn't get a job, even stacking shelves in a local supermarket, because mm-hmm. the algorithm which was used in the software, used as the first cut by almost everybody, there was something in his application that basically just said no straight away.
Oh, really?
Mm, and it was to do with an algorithm. And it was no great shakes or anything like that. It was just he'd used the wrong word or whatever it was. It's bizarre.
Algorithm awareness is very, very important, isn't it?
Anyway, the last paragraph of this particular article, which is very American, I have to say, he says, great edtech is rooted in clearly defined and articulated pedagogy. As you shepherd a concept into a product, can you describe the pedagogical underpinnings of this tech? To that end, we would challenge developers to ask themselves that question and to engage faculty, the pedagogy experts at all stages of developing tech. Further, developers need to take into account the populations and the institutions for whom they are developing. Digital redlining takes place when policymakers and designers make conscious choices about what kinds of tech and education are good enough for certain populations, but also happens through failure to interrogate policy and design. We all have a role to play in these interrogations. Any of us can ask about the policies and technologies that filter our access and track our interactions. To think about digital redlining is to historicize contemporary digital culture. An urgent task of these technologies are to help students reach their goals. Just before I finish that bit, there's actually a great... Ben Williamson wrote a great post on Codacts, which I've only scanned this week. But it's about an app called Class Dojo, which I'm sure you've either used or heard of.
Yeah.
And he talks about how simple it looks, but how complicated the whole system is behind it.
Okay.
And it's quite a long post, and here we are. Yeah, there we are. Decoding Class Dojo. And it's a few thousand words, has to be said, but I'll leave that there in case anyone's interested in, because he does a good job, from what I've scanned, of thinking, of getting behind the shiny surface to all of the things that are going on, and if it's a free app, how are they making money, and all that kind of stuff.
I had a really interesting conversation this week, or last week, with a gentleman called Dick Taylor. Do you know him?
Yes.
Well, so Dick Taylor is an interesting figure, and he makes money out of edtech, basically. And he's currently invested lots of money in five different edtech startups. And he lives near Oundle. So he invited me for a cup of tea at Brew Baboo, a very nice tea shop, should you ever visit Oundle. And he has such an oversight of EdTech from the business point of view. It's really, really quite interesting, very different understanding of it all to me. And it was fascinating to talk to him because of the millions and millions of pounds and the big contracts that get invested and spent and this, that and the other, and how they work and how companies are failing and how they're succeeding and what is the cause of their success, etc. And I don't want to go into any of that now, and I don't know with how much discretion I need to talk about it particularly, if any. But certainly he has a great insight into the sort of corporate side of EdTech and how it all functions and who's making a success of it and who isn't. Really very fascinating, which is connected to that article we've just been talking about, obviously, where they're trying to tell people. I mean, he's very much of the idea that he speaks to an EdTech company and they want his advice, which is he gets a lot of calls for that. That they get teachers involved in the design of their applications because people make these wonderful things and they...
Well, you need to know your audience, don't you?
And then very much.
Yeah.
But it's all about the real deal, you know? It's about making stuff that people actually want that solves real problems rather than just problems that you think, oh, yeah, that would be great, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah, the technology can do this thing, therefore we must build it.
Exactly, yeah.
Talking of things which... this thing is possible, therefore we should do it. There's a... So I think it was Stephen Downes linked to this thing, the CanTech newsletter, Canadian Technology Newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, have hashtags finally outlived their usefulness?
Oh, that's a controversial statement. Well, would you say they have, just as a knee-jerk reaction?
I think they're less useful than they're going to be, but then I think that anything is going to... Well, anything is going to get... Basically, a term, you can't just take something and keep it as that thing for all time when it's a word or a term.
Uh-huh.
Because people are going to abuse it either because they don't know what it means or because they willfully try and change it because they want to change the meaning of it towards a certain way. I mean, I've used this example before, but Elon Ezekiel gave me the example of somebody... This person said, he was talking about agile development and stuff. He's like, oh yeah, we do agile. Yeah, we've started doing agile now, place of work. Yeah, it's a bit annoying though, because you never know where you're going to sit. And he realized, of course, that they meant hot desking. And that person had used agile, either because they didn't know what it was, or maybe their manager had used the term agile to describe this thing. So of course, agile becomes less of a useful term. Now, this is a bit of a meta level of that, because obviously you can use any term and put a hashtag in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
But really, given the way that we can search things these days, keyword search, etc., I don't use as many hashtags as I used to, do you?
I always pop a hashtag or two in there if I've got something that I think might be relevant. So if I find something that I think is good for geography, I'll put the geography hashtag in or the jog chat hashtag in or something like that. Right. Just because I see my use of Twitter, which isn't great, as in a great volume. Of course, it's fantastic quality. but I would put something in that's trying to share it, and if I can put a hashtag in that I think will help share it to some more people, then I will do. Or indeed, I think hashtags are quite good at is if you put them in in a tweet or in a whatever. Instagram same or even Facebook the same, is that the people who are reading it, it's just a really quick way of saying geography teachers might be interested in this. You just hashtag your geography and you got, and it's less words, say more kind of thing.
Put obviously the open badges hashtag in and digital literacy. Yeah. So I just find it seems to me people are using that less, maybe. Twitter are changing, they're going to change next week or soon to not including, I mean, people are being expecting this for ages, but moving to not counting
links
and photos in the 140 characters.
Yeah, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But it's really just a different way of changing their modus operandi without actually changing it. But
there's no reason why they couldn't, for example, not count hashtags and give you a maximum of 3 hashtags you can add to a tweet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no reason why you couldn't do that. But also, this article is looking at hashtags in a very high level. Do you know what I mean? It's looking at SEO or looking at, you know, big words like advertising and things like that. Whereas hashtags are much more, can be used in much more simple ways. You can actually make them work for you, you know. So if you're working within a community and the community decides upon, like a conference, for example, decides upon a hashtag, and then everything that goes out goes with that hashtag in it. I don't think that's a
bad. That's how they start, isn't it? Chris Messina wanted a way in which people could easily find tweets about a particular topic at a bar camp or whatever it was. Whereas now, as you just touched on, it's kind of sullied and polluted by every advert ever having a hashtag on it.
Exactly. It's kind of overkill. So maybe there's a room for it to morph a little bit and evolve into something else. But I certainly think as a teacher, if I'm using social media or indeed the web to curate things with a group of other people, especially if they're not people that are located in the same room at the same time, that hashtags have great uses. You wouldn't want to be without them, kind of thing. The ability to insert some metadata into a piece of information that you're publishing on the web, and that it can come from different platforms and that kind of thing, because the hashtag is unique. I mean, then, you know, it doesn't matter what your hashtag is, kind of thing. Just as long as the people in the community know about it, and then others can pick up on it and maybe see what's going on. I don't know.
I definitely think they're useful. I just think that it's easy to get jaded about things that get picked up and just flogged to death by advertisers.
I remember once watching Celebrity Big Brother, the inaugural show. It was a few years ago. My family used to like watching it, so I was just suffering it. I hate that stuff. And so I went on Twitter and just followed the hashtag that was going on the screen. It was just really unpleasant. It was just like, so my usage of Twitter, I very rarely come across something that I find is unpleasant. Occasionally a conversation that has gone awry or something. But there was just so much unpleasantry going on. I didn't want to see it. I wasn't interested, you know? So the hashtag just made me think, well, anything with that hashtag is a thing I don't want to see.
Did you see that Instagram, I think it's today, have started letting everyone filter abusive words out of their comments?
Oh, really?
Yeah. Do you use Instagram?
I do.
There you go.
I don't get any abuse, though. No one ever talks to me. I just post what I like. It's a bit like my podcasting. We talk about what we like. And if someone likes that, that's kind of cool.
Okay. Well, there we go. We're just over an hour, so a bit shorter than usual. What are you up to this week, Di?
I haven't even really got there. Busy, so I haven't planned my week out. I plan my lessons, or some of them. I'm doing this induction for the sixth form tomorrow morning. I'm having meetings with several people. We're sort of doing an interesting thing with personal statements in the school. So I think I mentioned this in the last time, possibly, is that every upper six, every UCAS applicant has created their personal statement on a Google Doc and shared it with the careers department, their housemaster and their tutor, and they will share it with the teachers from whom they want advice on their statement connected to the subject they're applying for. So I'm just kind of been rolling that out and dealing with that at the beginning of term and changing. So our Google Apps rollout is quite in its infancy. And so I've just been dealing with a lot of that sort of thing, and we'll do some more about that and start getting that right. Our tech at the beginning of term has been a bit shoddy, and the children haven't been getting a good service. So I'm hoping to get that sorted. And then I hope to do some kind of tech TV thing for the pupils, like which will be me to camera, a few minutes video just explaining the tech that's available to them and giving them updates on what's going to happen and how things are going to roll, and putting my face on it, kind of thing, so that the 1,100 pupils at the school know that.
It's important for people to know who you are, and you're not just a faceless email signature.
Exactly. And then and for this week, I think that's pretty much it, other than my usual MO. How about yourself? What are you up to?
Well, it's Tuesday today, so we're recording this, so we need to find it at the time, and perhaps we can talk about that in a moment when we're going to record this, because you're now busy at a time where we used to do it, which is fine, and we might have a different release day if we record this later on in the week. So it's Tuesday. I decided, actually, so I wrote this blog post on my Discourses blog about increasing my serendipity surface, which sounds all grand, but it comes from Robert Greene's book Mastery, where he says that you need to have serendipitous interactions with people, and you can kind of plan for that by not just sitting in your home office all the time. So now that I'm not down in London every week, because that City and Guilds contract is finished, now I'm moving on to other things. What I'm doing is I'm working from Campus North in Newcastle every Monday. So I'm paying to do that. I'm hot desking there. I'm kind of part of their co-working space. And that's the home of the Ignite 100 technology accelerator. It means that I can schedule meetings there. People know I'm in town. They can ping me, do all that kind of stuff. So I did that yesterday for the first time and went to Gateshead Library today. Had a critical friend call this morning. Got a Creative Commons Thinkathon with my We Are Open colleagues this afternoon.
That's really exciting that you're working with Creative Commons.
Yeah. Excellent. I mean, the CEO used to work with me at Mozilla, and, you know, great people there. Alan Levine's doing some stuff with them. So really looking forward to digging into their certification program. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow I'm at Sunderland Council and Sunderland Software City thinking about a potential digital passport for the city and how I can be involved with that. And then I've got meetings around MozFest and just various potential like business development work stuff. Then off on Friday as usual. And then next week I'm off to Jersey to do the work that I've already mentioned before, kind of helping out in a similar role to you, but in a much more very part-time kind of consultancy basis. So
yeah. Okay, well, that should be fun.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, so if you manage to get here, you're listening, sorry, and you manage to get here, then let us know what you think of different kind of format and whether you think it's a good thing or a bad thing or whatever. That'd be great, I think.
And we'd love to read any blog posts or if you join our Slack channel, we'd love to hear from you about what you think about screen time, especially if you've got views different to ours. We'd love to have a debate, to read some more stuff. That's what we're here to do, provoke conversations, have conversations ourselves. And if you've got any suggestions about what you'd like to hear us talk about as our main topic, if you'd like to come on and discuss that with us, we'd love to hear from you. So get in touch with us either via Twitter, via the Slack channel. They're probably the best ways to get in touch with us in the first instance.
Absolutely. Sounds good. Right, have a good week. Thanks for listening.
Likewise. Cheers, Di.
Take care. Now I'm just going to sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time.